For the week of October 1st, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 382, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Lovelock Correctional Center in Northern Nevada, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, of course, you're at a correctional facility. You mean a penitentiary where you are locked up.
No, I'm not locked up. I'm outside. I've had a tip that O.J. is going to be released, and I'm here for us to get the world-exclusive first interview with O.J. Simpson.
Newsflash, it was released several days ago.
Shoot!
Yes.
By the way, I like the little bloop, bloop you did when I cursed on an episode recently. I heard that having ego listened to myself, or whatever one would call that, and that was very amusing. But, yeah, you know, O.J. is out. That means the flurry of attention will begin. Who will give him a book deal? Who will do a TV interview? Of course, they won't pay him for that interview, but they will pay for the use of photos and video and other exclusive material that they can pretend is not paying him. Will ESPN bring him on as a commentator to boost up football ratings? I'll bet OJ stands for the national anthem. It'll all be exciting to find out.
Yes, I don't think that ESPN is going to bring him on for anything, frankly.
And if they got an interview, they sure as heck would.
Well, maybe, yes, correct. If they got an interview, yes, they would do that. But then that would be disguised as journalism.
That's right. Well, he's free and out and about in the world. And I'm sure the first thing he's going to do is start listening to podcasts, because they really weren't around that much when he went in. And if he listens to our podcast, what will he hear about?
Well, the first thing he's going to hear is probably some construction noise here in our studio, because they're doing some construction right above my head. And actually, you can probably hear them banging away right now.
I thought you had zombies locked in the closet.
No. I think that they're all off on set over at The Walking Dead. In fact,
that's right. They finish up this season's shooting. At least they're scheduled to end the day before Thanksgiving.
Right.
My friend is on the set as a still photographer.
So yeah, they're still on set. But this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll catch up on 2 weeks worth of news since I was traveling last week. Don't worry. While the real world seems on permanent fast forward in terms of awful news, especially yesterday in Las Vegas, the world of entertainment was relatively quiet. That should keep this podcast at a running time no longer than the new movie Blade Runner 2049, which, by the way, I saw 30 minutes of in Brazil.
Saw 1/8 of it.
Yes, correct. Exactly. Among the movie news, popcorn sales are up, but that's not enough to keep independent movie theater owners happy. They're suing the chain Landmark on antitrust grounds. Coincidentally, Landmark sued Regal over the very same issue just a few years ago. During our book filter segment, Michael will tell us about a book set during World War II, and if it's not already optioned by Hollywood, he'll eat his shirt. So if you've optioned this book, okay, I want you to do us all a favor and drop it immediately. To put it into turnaround. On Inside Baseball, we'll catch up with the near-fatal car accident involving the star of TV's Riverdale and how it has raised, once again, the contentious issue of actors and crew getting to and from home after long days on the set. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're talking about box office around the world. We get our links from ComScore. It's in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit and Mojo, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, the LA Times, the New York Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is Kingsman, The Golden Circle, $67 million on the weekend, and is just under $200 million worldwide. Right below that is It, the Stephen King horror flick, $53 million on the weekend, $553 million worldwide. And jumping right to North America, because those two movies are right in the top three, this is as photo a finish as I've seen in ages. Three movies all claimed to gross about $17 million. They were all wrong, and they were all neck and neck. Literally just hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of dollars separated them. The number switched by Monday. We have the final actuals, and Kingsman, The Golden Circle, ended up on top with $16.9 million. And number two is It.
Well, actually, I'd like to say to that point, if you read on CJ over at Celluloid Junkie, you can actually, Jim Amos talks about that, about which studio is going to flinch and release their numbers first, because everybody knows, okay, this is pretty close on Saturday. They know, geez, this is going to be one of those horse race weekends where there's not one that's $53 million over the other. And so, you know, you have Warner Brothers waiting for Fox to release the Kingsman numbers and American...
And Universal.
Right. And they're, well, and I think Warner Brothers released their numbers first and then everybody else released theirs. I can't remember who released first, but then that's exactly what happens. Everybody's saying, well, you made $17 million. I made $17,100,000. And then...
Well, how about just being honest?
Well...
Why wait? Just tell the truth. In fact... Warner Brothers went from first to third, I believe. So with it, so they exaggerated the most and had to correct the least. Kingsman was closest to its actual final totals. So that went from first to third, and American Made went from second to third. Is that confusing? All three movies switched position. All three actually grossed less than they claimed on Sunday night. Kingsman was the most honest. It made only about $30,000 more than It, the horror film. And both of them were, in this context, I guess, substantially ahead of American Made because they made almost $130,000 more. So this is a really tight race. All just under $17 million. All three of them, It's overperforming. Kingsman had a better hold. American Made is, of course, a pretty modest total for Tom Cruise. One of his lower grossing movies as far as the opening weekend is concerned. We'll have to see where it ends up, but overseas hasn't been great for it yet, so it's going to be a tough one, but I'm sure it has some big markets to go. So circling back, $67 million for Kingsman worldwide, $53 million for It, the horror film, and a lot of new movies opened up in China. Why? Because it's National Day. I forgot to look up this holiday. It's National Day.
It's the Golden Week. Yeah, it's some Golden Week thing going on there.
It's a patriotic holiday of some sort in China. So a lot of movies opened up. And the winner in that box office race is at number three worldwide. It's Never Say Die. It's a Chinese comedy about a guy and a girl who fall into a swimming pool just as lightning strikes and thus swap bodies. We've all had that happen to us, and it grossed $45 million on the weekend. Right below that is another new Chinese film. It's The Foreigner, an action thriller. It's actually in English. It stars Jackie Chan as a Londoner whose past comes back to haunt him when I think his teenage daughter is kidnapped or killed, and Pierce Brosnan is a suspicious UK government official keeping an eye on him. That made $23 million on the weekend. Skipping down to number seven is Chasing the Dragon, another Chinese film. This is an Andy Lau film. He stars as a gangster, a real-life gangster named Lee Rock. This is like the third or fourth film in the series, and it grossed $15 million on the weekend. Right below that is the most patriotic of all these movies. It's Sky Hunter. It's a Chinese war film about the Air Force, and they're saying it's like the first aerial war movie, and they had the cooperation of the military, sort of like their wings, I guess, going back to our silent era. But it's the directorial debut of star Li Chen, who shot to fame on the TV game show Running Man, which is a spin on a South Korean game show. And it's sort of like the amazing race with celebrities. That's sort of the impression I get. They go to big famous spaces and do stunts and activities to try to win prizes. That one made $13 million. And then below that is City of Rock. This is a Chinese comedy about a young rock musician who hopes to save his town's beloved Rock Park by holding a benefit rock concert. It's written, directed, and starring Cheng Ping Dong. I assume he also wrote the songs. And that one made about $11 million on the weekend. So that's four movies, is it? Four movies that opened up in China, all battling for the audiences that showed up on this big holiday known as National Day.
How many Chinese films were in the top 10 then?
Well, there's three, four, seven, eight. So all four of them were five. Five of the top 10 films were from China alone. They might have played in one or two or three territories. There's three territories for that one, four for Chasing the Dragon, three and two. So mostly China and Hong Kong with one or two other territories thrown in. Five of the top 10 films debuted in China. Or are in their second weekend or something like that. Are they? No, that's first weekend. No, they're all debuts. So there you go. I hadn't even thought about that, but you're right. The top 10 is dominated by China. At number five is the Lego Ninjago movie, $22 million on the weekend, $60 million worldwide. At number six is the Tom Cruise film we were talking about, American Made. That's where he's a guy in the 80s, sort of a ne'er-do-well top gun. It made $20 million on the weekend. It's at $80 million worldwide. That finally matches the total budget of the film. It's in 62 territories right now. I'm hoping for its sake it has some big ones to go. It's going to be a long haul to get to $240 million. Jumping down to number 9. I should have looked up the pronunciation of this film. Darn it, I forgot to do that. Judwa 2. This is a Hindi comedy. It's not a sequel, even though it's called Judwa 2. It's sort of a remake of Judwa. I don't know why they call it Judwa 2, but I guess to distinguish it from the old one. That Hindu comedy came out in 1997, and that itself is a remake of a 1994 Indian comedy made in the Telugu language. So it was first made in the Telugu language, then remade in Hindi in 1997, and now they've remade it again in 2017. So they love this movie, and this weekend it opened to $12 million, including an opening here in North America.
Now, keep in mind that, you know, India is a pretty big place geographically speaking, so, and it's got several different dialects. So when you have movies and stories that people like, they will often make it in the different regional dialects, especially since there are certain laws that require you to release movies in those languages.
Well, these were hit films. I mean, it was a hit film in Telugu. It was a hit film again in Hindi. And now 20 years later, they're taking another stab at it. So I think this is more of a commercial choice rather than a we've got to fill some quota.
Well, there's that, too.
But my point here, something I'd like to bring up, is the fact that the Japanese animated film Your Name is being remade. J.J. Abrams got the rights to it. They're obviously going to do a big Hollywood live action version of this animated film. You may remember it was a huge worldwide smash everywhere except North America. And it's about two teenagers who meet in their dreams. In their dreams, a boy and a girl meet each other in their dreamscape, and it goes on from there. It's well worth seeing in the original animated version. And now Hollywood is going to do a big budget remake, to which somebody immediately said, they're going to whitewash it. What's your response to that?
I don't really even know. You're probably right. I don't know what my response should be. Is what, you know, why not just release the original version in North America, for Pete's sake?
Well, they did. They did release the animated version. They're now making a live action version. My point is, movies get remade all the time. You're not whitewashing a story of teenagers, you know, unless you set it in Japan and had a white person play it. I mean, they're just going to be, it's going to be an English language version with kids named Joey and Suey, you know, unless it's something wildly specific to a particular culture and you're playing a Mexican or a Japanese person and someone not of that ethnicity is doing it, then that's not whitewashing. That's just a remake, and it's been done for 100 years, and it's not insulting or wrong to take a great story and put it, you know, Japanese films get made into French films, get made into South Korean films, get made into English films. It happens all over the world. It's not an insult. And if it's happening here, don't get angry just because they're white and think, oh, how dare they? You know, there's some times where it feels wrong, like what was the Scarlett Johansson film?
Ghost in the Shell.
Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
Ghost in the Shell. You know, that's an iconic Asian character. They even tried to make her sort of look Asian. It's all influenced and sort of intrinsically set in that culture, and that made that offensive and wrong. But this isn't that kind of uniquely specific story. It's sort of a universal tale. It could be made in South Korean, which could then be made into Russian, which could then be made into English. So relax.
Well, I guess that's why when you asked me, I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to say to this. My reaction is that, you know, there is no reaction, really. Now, well, speaking of remaking movies, Flatliners was remade, and people said, well, why are you doing that? And in fact, not only people in Hollywood said, why are you doing that? Audiences said, why are you doing that? And then didn't go see it.
It grossed $10 million on the weekend, and they just couldn't bring it back to life.
Oh, I knew you were going to do something like that.
And number 12 is American Assassin. My mind is blanking about what this movie is about. I've forgotten already.
This is the Michael Keaton movie, right?
Oh, right. There you go. The Michael Keaton film. $5 million on the weekend, just under $50 million worldwide. And number 13 is the reviled, the despised, the cult classic Mother. $5 million on the weekend, $35 million worldwide. I'm sure people will be championing it at the end of the year just because. And number 14 is perhaps Judi Dench's last feature film. It's Victoria and Abdul. It grossed $5 million on the weekend, $20 million worldwide. Not great ending for a great career.
Why do
so
you
it's
say,
nice to see her.
Why do you say it's her last great film? Or last feature
not,
film?
Not last great. It's a terrible film. I'm saying it's probably her last film because she is nearly blind. She is been doing the press tour, but she is... She's 83. She's virtually blind. She had to have this script read to her. She's just not physically capable, I don't think, of doing any other movies. I doubt any more will be coming along. She's just, you know, too frail and physically not up to it. So it's a shame and sad. But as you see her going around doing press, it's clear that this is probably a last hurrah. I don't mean that she's dying tomorrow, but, you know, she can't see. The way the film was shot, you can see that they sort of edited around her where she has scenes with people. But when she's talking, you're getting a close-up of her. You're not seeing her talk to the other person. You're seeing her in close-up, and you felt like maybe she couldn't make good eye contact with them, or they were just trying to give her a light load and let her get her scenes done. But everything about how it was arranged and done shows them sort of working around her and giving her as much freedom to get through the role as they could, which is sweet and touching. She's a wonderful actor. She's not bad in this movie, even though the movie is bad, but she's just, you know, at the end of her run. And number 15 is Cars 3, another $5 million on the weekend, $370 million worldwide. Clearly a disappointment for Disney, at least at the box office. Number 16, Emoji, the Emoji Movie, almost $200 million, so that's doing fine. And number 17, a South Korean comedy. It's called I Can Speak. It must have opened last, I don't remember this last weekend, but oh no, we were off last week, weren't we? So it probably opened 2 weekends ago. It's at $9 million total, and it's a light comedy about an elderly woman who's constantly complaining to local bureaucrats, and then she bonds with a lowly civil servant as he teaches her how to speak English. It sounds adorable. If they were remaking it in English, it might star Judi Dench, except it wouldn't make any sense because she already knows how to speak English. And number 18 is Battle of the Sexes. That widened a bit. That's at $4 million now total. Clearly, I don't think this is going to be a player come at the end of the year. People are mostly indifferent to it. It's not that good a movie. The reviews have been, at best, polite. Looking down for any attention, here's one. At number 21, a Russian drama called Krim. That is a word for Crimea or for the port that they're at. And it's a Russian drama about that country's illegal invasion and occupation of Crimea, which I assume is not the angle that the film takes. But it opened up, I assume, in Russia and grossed $2 million. It was a little hard to figure out what they were saying or doing from the trailer because there were no English subtitles. And that's about it for the movies. That's about it for anything interesting. I wanted to mention this from North America, Loving Vincent. Have you seen this film?
I have not seen this film.
It's a film about Vincent Van Gogh and his relationship, I think, with his brother or towards the end of his life. And what's unique about it is that it was made by drawing like 50,000 paintings in the style of Van Gogh. That's how they animated the movie, making tens of thousands of individual paintings in the style of Van Gogh. So it's just a technically stunning film. Everybody says that. And if you look at the ratings, this movie got a 91% right now on Rotten Tomatoes. That's from the top critics. That means it's great, right? But if you actually read the reviews, I think 2 out of 15 actually say it's good. If you read them, they're all like, you know, it's a little weak, dramatically, blah, blah, blah. But boy, is it stunning. It's really an accomplishment. It's really cool looking. It's kind of worth it just to see that. But none of them say it's actually good. So if you want a classic example of Rotten Tomatoes and how that one number is not a good indication of whether a movie is great or terrible or what, this is it. Loving Vincent. Everybody thought it was interesting and visually cool. Nobody virtually thought it was actually good. And yet it has a 91% rating because everyone who saw it said, you know, it's kind of interesting just to see, just for that visual style. That's kind of cool.
Right.
So keep that in mind.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, now that you mention it, I do kind of remember this film. And I think it played the festival circuit because I remember seeing, you know, segments of this movie. And you're right, it was visually stunning. But I didn't sit through it because, you know, there was nothing more than the paintings. And after a while, I thought, I think I've seen this story before.
Yeah, you've seen this story before, Vincent and Theo, directed by Robert Altman, one of his great films from his period where he wasn't making Altman-like movies. He had very low budgets and was making movies like Streamers and Vincent and Theo and Secret Honor, all of which I really like a lot. I think they're undervalued in terms of his whole career. But Vincent, Loving Vincent, about the great painter Van Gogh, the Chinese love him. I'm sure it'll play China someday. And if it does, how much money will it make? Who knows?
Yes, it will make a whole lot of nothing, actually. And even if it made money, whatever it makes will be underreported, no doubt.
Talk to us. We just got a story from the Wall Street Journal, didn't we?
Yes, this is late breaking news. And yet I read this and go, yeah, and you didn't think that was happening already? Like, didn't we all know this was happening? And it's basically the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, and PricewaterhouseCoopers, they did an audit of Chinese exhibitors, and they said, you know what? We think Chinese exhibitors are underreporting the grosses to U.S. films, to Hollywood films, by as much as 9 or 10%, to which I say, Yeah, of course they are. You didn't think that was actually happening?
So looking at last year, we think there's about $470 million from international box office, and they would get about 25%. You know, they would get 25% of the box office from international grosses, and that would be almost $500 million. And they think about $40 to $45 million of that has gone missing. And now this is all part of the agreement between China and the U.S. China and the U.S. constantly arguing over unofficial bans on American films and international films. And part of the agreement was, you're going to let us do an audit. And this is just the first step in their audit, isn't it?
Yes, and it's also the first step in a very long negotiation, because of course the China Film Group, the only group that's allowed to distribute imported films in China, and it's a government, pretty much a government company, said, well, we can't do anything about it. You're going to have to, you know, if you want something done about box office control, you're going to have to go further up in the government than us. We don't control the exhibitors. So now the finger pointing starts. But really what the MPAA is doing here is beginning negotiations. And somebody obviously leaked this to the Wall Street Journal because they're trying to negotiate through the press, which is one way to negotiate in these kinds of situations where, you know, you're basically saying to an entire industry, hey, if you do business in China, be warned.
Well, but isn't China cracking down on its own theatrical exhibitors as well? So it's not necessarily out of line with what the government wants to do. They were cracking down on people misreporting who was buying tickets for what. They were cracking down on all sorts of shenanigans, weren't they?
Yes, they were. I guess the question here is, okay, are you underreporting in general, or are you underreporting on one group of films that just happens to be Hollywood films?
Well, we're going to guess probably all of them, right?
Probably all of them. I guess what the Wall Street Journal is implying is, gee, there are a lot of films being released in China, and it looks like in the top, what was it, the top five, they're all Chinese films, which would normally be completely understandable, except, you know, it's, I think, maybe the first year that happened.
Well, they've been growing and growing, though, haven't they?
Yes, they have. So the top five grossing films in China were The Mermaid, Zootopia, which was a Disney film, Warcraft, which I guess you could consider a Hollywood film, The Monkey King 2, and Captain America Civil War. So I got that wrong. I was trying to...
That's pretty good. It's about 2.5 out of 5.
Yeah.
And they've clearly been growing dramatically in terms of their appeal, both to Chinese audiences and internationally, especially in Asia. And those are good examples of it. They're sort of competing head-to-head with Hollywood, which is a new story. And of course, I bet they're selling popcorn as well.
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the things. The auditors found that there were irregularities throughout the exhibitors' receipts, including ticket sales that were categorized as concessions.
And, oh, really?
Yes. And I do wonder if I'm sure I could find this out, what the most popular concession items are in China. Because certainly,
it's fried grasshoppers, I believe.
Oh, now that's
no.
Just,
I'm kidding.
Yeah,
I'm culturally insensitive. What do I know? Maybe it's popcorn. You should find out.
That's true. I can tell you, coming back from Brazil, it most certainly is popcorn. In Brazil, Brazil has become the second largest popcorn exporter in the world after the United States.
Really?
Yes. In just a very few, you know, very, they were literally not on even on the list, and in a very short period of time, they are now the number two exporter and grower of popcorn.
Well, talk to us about popcorn sales in North America.
Well, they rose 16.9%, and that's ready-to-eat popcorn. That's 160 million pounds. That's a lot.
That's a lot, and it's a growth?
That is growth. It's annual revenue of $1.5 billion, according to David Walsh of Snack International, and he's the snack industry's trade group.
Well, I do know that in China, they like dried salted plums.
Okay.
And in South Korea, they're fond of dried cuttlefish. That's a popular snack at movie theaters.
Yeah. Now, certainly, look, you know, one of the trends in movie theaters is to serve kind of higher end food, actual meals, whether it be in VIP settings or, you know, kind of Alamo Drafthouse settings. Or if it's, you know, before the film where there's a cafe in the theater. But every exhibitor you talk to says popcorn is still the king. Popcorn and soda still rules.
I wish they just didn't charge such high margins, because it makes me not want to buy it.
Yes, I would agree with that. And they would say, well, that's kind of where we make our money. But you know, that
can... Yeah, but you're not, because I literally buy popcorn maybe once or twice a year, because I feel like, you know what, it's just, I feel cheated when I pay more for popcorn and a soda than the ticket.
Yes, and they actually have, you know, calculations where they look at how many people walk through their cinemas without buying anything.
That's me.
And actually, I just did a piece for Celluloid Junkie on Jennifer Douglas, who was in charge of both concessions, and now she's in charge of in-theater dining for AMC Theaters. And she talked about the fact that, you know, most people don't purchase anything when they walk through the door beyond the ticket, and they're trying to change that.
Well, lower the price, Jennifer. Why don't you have her on the show? You should do more cross promotions of Celluloid Junkie.
I know, I should. I'm not saying it enough on this episode, am I?
No. I'm saying you should have more guests. If you have somebody on Celluloid Junkie and they're good, you should bring them on the show.
Yes, she is really good. I mean, she really knows what she's doing when it comes to, you know, she's increased sales. She's increased not only at the concession stand, but now at through in-theater dining and the bars. She's been with the company something like 28, 29. I mean, she's been at the company since she was 15 years old.
Oh, that's cool. Well, she knows AMC, but I wonder about indie theater chains, the art house circuit, whether they make as much in concessions. I'm assuming not, because those types of movies and the people who go to them are somehow more sober and serious, and they're less likely to be munching popcorn. But that's just a guess.
Yeah, I'd actually wonder that myself. That's a good question. Although I can tell you this much, whatever they're making, they're going to have to actually pay out in legal fees. Due to a lawsuit, there are some art houses that are suing Landmark Theaters, and there's Landmark Cinemas, which is in Canada, and they were just purchased by Kinepolis out of, I think it's Belgium. And then there's Landmark Theaters, which is here in the U.S., and they're known for being kind of an art house, an upscale art house. There's some in, you know, they're in a number of different cities and states. And they sued Regal a couple of years ago for what was known as clearance, where Regal, AMC, Cinemark, in this case, they were just suing Regal, but Regal was saying, oh, you can't give a film to Landmark because you're playing the film, Mr. Studio Executive, you're playing it in our theater, and Landmark is just down the street, and we don't want them pulling the film, you know, customers away from us, so please don't play the film at that Landmark theater, and if you do, we want better terms. So, of course,
don't you often find that, like, if it's at AMC, it won't be at the other one. It won't be at, you know, I mean, isn't that sort of common that you look at theaters across the street from each other and one has a certain batch of movies and the other one has the other batch of movies?
If it's that close, yes, that is correct. However, more and more, if they're a few blocks apart, clearance is going away. Why? Because the studios don't want to have to deal with antitrust. So they don't want to have to deal with it. They're basically saying, look, we'll give it to both of you and may the best man win. If you're across the street, okay, sure, we understand. So it used to be if something was playing at the Chinese here in Los Angeles, you know, which has like six screens, it generally didn't play at the Arclight, which is on Sunset Boulevard. They're a couple blocks apart. You could probably walk to them within 10, maybe 15 minutes. But now it doesn't seem to matter. If one's playing a film, it might also be playing at the Arclight.
So did Landmark succeed in its suit against Regal?
You know, I was trying to figure that out. I think it was settled out of court.
And now the indies are suing Landmark saying, hey, you're asking for exclusivity, and that's a problem under antitrust. And what's unusual about this case? There's something different, isn't there?
Well, this is the first time a group of theater owners, a group of art house theater owners, have gone in and sued another exhibitor, one of their, you know, colleagues, so to speak, one of their contemporaries, over a product market where they say, look, this is just first run specialty films. This isn't all films. It's just art house films. It's independent films. It's foreign films. Maybe it's documentaries. Maybe it's shorts. Maybe it's film festival movies.
The type of film that we carry, a specific type of film that we are known for, and you're saying you want exclusivity on that type of film.
Correct.
And is Landmark saying film to film, or are they saying we want all the art house films?
I think it's film to film. Well, it has to be film to film here in the United States, because of course there's you know rules against block booking, but it, you know, so it's definitely film to film here in the U.S.
Do they have a good case? Will it be settled out of court because the studios were worried about antitrust? Or what's going to happen?
Well, what'll wind up happening is, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, the lawsuit is filed and then Landmark goes, all right, we're going to stop asking for it. And, you know, please just dismiss your lawsuit. You've won, you know, unless they're seeking damages. If they're trying to seek damages, then it will continue on these other exhibitors. But if not, then they got their way. The Landmark will stop insisting on having exclusives on art house material. Now, alternatively, if Landmark continues to insist on exclusive bookings, then absolutely this will move forward. But I can't imagine they would continue to insist on that.
Because you think they'll lose?
Clearances have a spotty track record when it comes to legal disputes.
So why wouldn't they continue and say, well, let's find out what the courts say. We feel like we deserve. We're in a small town. We want to have the only art. We want to be the only person showing Call Me By Your Name, for example, when that opens up. We don't want to compete with the local art house because we're competing for the same movie and the same audience. And there's not enough people to go around for two theaters in this area.
Well, what I would say is they probably don't want to call attention to this point. That area may be in dispute. Other areas may not be. They probably don't want to be calling attention to it.
So studios aren't doing it much anymore.
Correct.
But it's the art house world. So it's not, Warner Brothers and Fox. We're talking tiny little indie distributors who might change from week to week. This week it's A24. Next week it's Sony Picture Classics. The week after that is somebody else.
Correct. And that's why I guess Landmark feels they can push them around or has more. They can have more influence over those distributors.
But isn't there an argument that if you are in a town, a college town, say, and there's an art house that shows movies and there's your local cinema. And if the local cinema wants to show the art house film, they're like, don't show it at the local art house movie because we want the audience. There's not enough audience to go around for this film.
Right. Absolutely.
I'm not showing empathy for this. I'm showing just as much empathy for the art house people. Maybe they should say we want the exclusivity. But isn't there an argument? Hey, it shouldn't be on five screens in our town. We want to be the only one showing it.
Yes, there is an argument for that. That's where clearance actually comes into play. That's where it works.
All right. Well, I don't know. It seems it might just be the thing that the art house people say, hey, we're the ones who are faithful to you. They're just throwing it on an extra screen, whereas we cultivate the audience, give us the exclusive right. So, I'm not necessarily pushing for the big chain to win, but I think it's an interesting case. But they may, maybe the indie chains will claim damages. I know Legendary is damaged. They're a film production company, and they just had two investors bail on them.
Yeah, Legendary, you might recall, it's probably best known for producing the Batman movies, right? They had this deal, this output deal with, not an output deal, but a financing deal with Warner Brothers, where they kind of co-financed all of these Warner Brothers films, a slate financing deal. And they, out of that came Batman. And then along comes Wanda, purchases them, Wanda being the Chinese company that now owns AMC Theaters as well, and Hoyts in Australia. They purchased Legendary for $3 billion, kind of floated it on the Hong Kong, I think it was Hong Kong, the stock exchange there, and it's not doing very well.
Legendary doesn't have that deal with Warner Brothers anymore, does it?
No, it does not. Actually, I think it's Universal that they have a deal with now.
And their movies, the Legendary films, are doing well in China, but they're not performing overseas. Key execs have left. They've lost hundreds of millions of dollars, and now two key investors have bailed on them in the midst of the government having sort of all sorts of strictures on Wanda itself, which Legendary would say, hey, that's not affecting us.
Yeah, their exact statement was, Legendary is well capitalized with liquidity to fund its films and TV slates and operate its business as usual. Now, where have we heard that before? In one of Wanda's other assets, AMC. They said the same thing.
That true? Do you know that it's not true?
No, I'm sure it is true that they basically have been funded because they're a public entity now, and so they're kind of separate. But, China is looking at the Daily and Wanda group. They're looking at the Daily and Wanda's group, Wang Jianlin. You don't want to be hanging out with people that the government is coming after, and that's what these investors are doing. They're getting out of the way.
Well, they're stating the obvious, and they have to, because people are saying, we better run for the hills. If two key investors flee, you're forced to state the basic obvious facts of your business, I guess, which I would do when it comes to box office, by the way. It's now October. We just finished up September, and September, by the way, was the best September in North American box office history.
Yes.
Huzzah! Thank you, It. Thank you, Kingsman and other movies. The best September ever. The best spring ever. The fourth best winter ever. And yet all we've heard is how disastrous the year is, how quickly they forget. Suddenly everything's wonderful again. So the analysts are just week to week ping-ponging about. It was a poor summer, but it's a full year now. They're budgeting movies and releasing movies every month of the year. And that means summer might slow down a little bit, but spring and winter and September, normally quieter periods, are now a lot more robust. And long term, that is for the best for Hollywood.
I think you should write a book about it.
And if I did, we'd talk about it on Book Filter.
That's right. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And every week, Michael, you kind of review all the books being, or at least most of them, that are being released by publishers each week. And you tell us which books we should be paying attention to. That's over on bookfilter.com. But here on Showbiz Sandbox, you bring some of the titles that you think, well, we should be paying attention to for, or Hollywood should be paying attention to for, whether it be a TV show or a movie. These books are worth optioning or taking a deeper look at.
That's right. And this week, I'm sure it's already been optioned. It's Manhattan Beach by Pulitzer Prize winner Jennifer Egan. It's literary fiction. It's her first historical novel, and it's set before and during World War II. There's a little girl who's with her father as a child, and she sees he has this, she's not sure what's going on with him and this other man, what their shady relationship is or what's going on there. But later she grows up, it's the war, she starts working in a factory, and she becomes a diver who goes down underwater to repair and fix the ships that are going out to fight the war. And it's a whole sprawling tale set during World War II. She learns about her father's mysterious past. But she is a critically acclaimed best-selling author. This is the backdrop of World War II, a female diver. If it's not already optioned, I'll eat my shirt.
You know what? It's funny, but I didn't realize when you said that earlier, I didn't realize that it was a Jennifer Egan book, and that certainly, the subject matter is compelling. But given the subject matter, given the author, I would eat your shirt if this thing isn't already optioned.
Yeah, so Scott Rudin has it at the very least. But since that's already taken, you might consider Dunbar by Edward St. Aubin. Edward St. Aubin wrote a series of acclaimed, thinly veiled autobiographical novels. And now he's part of a series of retelling of Shakespeare set in different eras. In this case, he's tackled King Lear. And he said, well, if I'm putting King Lear in today, well, he wouldn't be a politician. There's no kings anymore, really, that matter. And a politician is sort of transient. And he wanted somebody more like a king was back then. And he decided on a media mogul. Obviously, we think Murdoch, and he says, no, I wasn't thinking Murdoch, but this is a tale of a media mogul and his children and splitting up his empire, and it's getting great reviews. So, if Manhattan Beach is taken and you're looking for a property, this sounds like a ripe film for development.
Ripe book for development.
A right book for development to turn into a film. And, it's easy now. It's out and you can pick it up in hardcover or ebook. It's not available in paperback yet, but there is a factoid here that ebook sales went up in May. And that's the first time in 2 years ebook sales have risen from that same month 1 year earlier in North America.
Or as Amazon would like to say, you see, publishing companies, we told you there was price elasticity. $9.99 was the price point.
Right. You're claiming that ebook sales have risen because prices have been lowered.
No, I'm just saying that they Amazon said, look, if you raise prices, you will be selling fewer books.
Right, and that's what happened, and it's very frustrating. But today, it just worked the right way. I saw the film Call Me By Your Name at the film festival. I was not happy with it. I was quite disappointed. And I wonder, what did I miss from what was in the book? I want to read the book now before I write my review. I didn't have a chance to read it before. I looked online. I looked at the Strand bookstore, and I looked at all the things. At the Strand, it's $15 in paperback. Online at Amazon, it's $12 in paperback. But Kindle, $10. Kindle for the $10 for this book that came out a few years ago, sort of a modest bestseller. $10, it's on my Kindle already. I've got it. I don't have to go to the store. I don't have to have it shipped to me. It's ready to read right now. It was the lowest price of all the options. That's how it works. That's when you get an impulse buy.
It's almost like you were wandering down the grocery aisle to the checkout stand.
That's right. And as I wandered home to do this show, I passed an Amazon bookstore. Amazon has a bookstore on 34th Street. I went in. It's weird. It's weird, their bookstores, because I have, they have algorithms of how they decide what to show, where, when, why, and how. In the bookstore, it's such a random choice of course, new releases. But then there's like some classics and just some perennial children's books and some, you're just like, how do they decide what to put in here? Because it has very few books compared to like a big, mega store or the Strand or something like that. And it's just a weird mix of new stuff and then some random older stuff and then some random classic stuff. And I literally have no idea how they came up with what they're showing in that store. But at least it was nice to be able to browse for a change.
Now, when you actually walked through the doors, did you hear a voice? Hello, Michael. Welcome. May we recommend the following?
Yes. I know you're looking at movies about older men and younger men. Perhaps you'd enjoy this book as well.
Yes. Exactly.
Perhaps you'd enjoy Morris by E.M. Forster. That's exactly what they're doing. And we'll have to see how it works out.
Well, that wraps up Book Filter and moves us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, I guess we could say this is important. Measuring TV watching has never been harder. We talk about it all the time, Michael, right?
Mm-hmm.
And two of the companies trying to be part of the solution are now fighting over what measuring TV even means. Nielsen and Comscore are arguing over how to interpret an Obama-era FCC consent decree. In order to gain approval for a merger, Nielsen agreed to let Comscore use some proprietary technology when measuring the overlap between TV viewing on the web and on televisions. They're now trading blows over exactly what that means, with Comscore pushing to be a more full-service player in TV ratings, and Nielsen saying, whoa, 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 that's kind of what we do. At the same time, Nielsen is offering advertisers a new ratings measurement. Forget eyeballs or demos. Nielsen wants to offer metrics like, here's somebody likely to buy a new car, or likely to purchase lunchtime snacks, and so on. Ooh, I guess I fall into that category. This likely consumer of TV ratings isn't so sure about that. I can tell you this that much. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess, unless there's a battle royale and we learn more about TV measuring and there's a real full competitor to Nielsen providing measurements that we can get our hands on. And by the way, if you have Nielsen ratings, I'd love to see the plus sevens for the new fall season once they're available. And if you can, reach out to us. How would they do that, Sperling?
Well, they can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. Now, we were just talking about books and book sales, but Bill O'Reilly isn't exactly making a killing at bookstores. His latest title in the nonfiction history series is focused on the American Revolution. It's called Killing England, and first week sales are 65,000 copies, according to Publishers Weekly. That's great by almost any standard, except O'Reilly's. The last two books that he wrote sold 110,000 copies and 140,000 copies in their first week, benefiting from his high-profile platform on Fox News. Even worse, O'Reilly was kept out of the top spot by Hillary Clinton's memoir. Ouch. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, we'll have to wait. The question is, because he doesn't have the platform of a nightly TV show in prime time, does that mean people are less likely to buy the books, or they're just not aware of it being out yet? So if through the end of the year sales pick up and he's a steady seller and it matches the last two, it won't matter how he started out of the gate. But clearly not having that visibility hurt him at the start.
Well, of course, and also being off the show for the reasons he's off the show, charges of sexual harassment, that's also an issue.
Perhaps.
Correct.
I don't know about the people who buy his books and whether they care about that.
Right. Now, the tragic death of a location scout in Mexico just got a grisly twist. The family of drug lord Pablo Escobar is suing over various infringements on their name and people implying that they are responsible for the man's death. It's a bitter trademark dispute, perhaps gone deadly, and certainly one as lurid as anything on the TV drama Narcos. Big deal or big whoop?
People aren't there implying that they're responsible. It's not other people. They're implying it. They're like, be careful when you're here in Mexico. You don't know how things work here.
Okay.
Yeah, no, they're like, that was us, basically, is what they said. You're like, oh my God, it's frightening. And now what the hell do they do? Do they shoot in Mexico? I sure as hell wouldn't. You know, the new season was going to move and be filmed in Mexico. Can you take it there and feel safe?
No.
I mean, no. Do you want to go there as an actor now when they're targeting the show and trying to rustle up money from them and implying that they killed one of the people who work on the show? My God. So I think they just have to relocate to another country, which is disastrous for Mexico, of course, because, you know, they obviously want film production. And they want people to come and be safe and whatever. So it's a nightmare for them. It's obviously a far worse tragedy for the family of the person who was killed. But now with this show, I can't see how they can film there in Mexico. They've got to go somewhere else.
Well, look, Mexico is not safe.
I wouldn't say all of Mexico is not safe, but not for this show with a target on its back.
Correct. Yes. Especially when you're filming a movie or a television show about Pablo Escobar, a guy who was a drug dealer.
Yes.
Or drug runner. What would you say?
Drug lord.
Drug lord. Okay. I don't know. Anyway, speaking of stories I didn't want to cover, dear God, can no one behave responsibly at a place of work? Sexual harassment allegations have dogged Fox News for years. They've spread to an indie cinema in Los Angeles, Cinefamily.
What was their name?
Cinefamily,
that's right.
The Alamo Drafthouse chain, and now even Harry Knowles of Ain't It Cool News. One woman came forward about a long ago incident concerning Knowles. As we've seen many times, when one person goes public, numerous others step forward with credible allegations, often reported to others at the time. This prompted an exodus of top contributors from Ain't It Cool News until Knowles himself stepped away and put his sister in charge while making the usual noises about needing help without actually confirming any of the charges. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, like you, it's just a big ugh that I don't want to talk about. But you need to. You know, it's not just Fox News, apparently. It's everywhere. And thank God people are coming forward and feeling confident enough that people will take their allegations seriously. You can't string someone up just on a single allegation, but when you get multiple ones and multiple people and you hear about how they handled it poorly for years, which is what we're talking about in context here, that becomes very disturbing and upsetting, and change needs to happen.
I don't even want to go into this because, you know, from the Alamo Drafthouse to Ain't It Cool News, I mean, it's just one of those...
Depressing.
Yeah, and quite honestly, there's been some debate about whether we cover this. You know, I hate to mention Celluloid Junkie's name again, but you know, whether we cover this at CJ, and you know, and how we cover it, and what we can add to it, and it's just, it's depressing. You're right, and it's depressing on all fronts. So that said, we'll leave it at that and move on to our next story. It's about the innovative thinking on TV and at the movies. And in theater, because it continues, all that innovative thinking. They're doing a new Halloween film and bringing back Jamie Lee Curtis, which, hey, that's great. They're doing another Terminator film and bringing back Linda Hamilton. On TV, CBS is turning the noirish Oscar-winning film L.A. Confidential into a drama. HBO is tackling the graphic novel classic The Watchmen. Fox is turning the Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe action comedy The Nice Guys into a TV series as well, except this time they'll be The Nice Girls. But that's not it, Grasshopper. They're also remaking the TV series Kung Fu with a woman, setting it in the 1950s and pairing her with a male Korean War veteran. ABC is rebooting The Greatest American Hero, but this time it's totally different. Instead of a white guy, it will star a woman of color. Party of Five is rebooting, this time with a Latino immigrant family. And on Broadway, of course, you have the upcoming musicals based on The Mean Girls, SpongeBob SquarePants, Frozen, the Zac Efron comedy 17 again, Archie Comics, the drama Beaches, the Honeymooners, and Pretty Women. Big deal or big whoop?
I mean, we started this story like 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we held a couple weeks, and I just kept adding to it. And it's just going to be a weekly segment of stuff that they're remaking that you're like, oh, whatever. You know, like sometimes you go, okay, great. Other times you're like, really? I don't know. Most of these you kind of go, huh, really? Doesn't seem like a lot of smart thinking is going on.
And it's not Pretty Women, it's Pretty Woman, right?
Yeah, it's Pretty Woman. Just one.
Yeah, okay. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Did we even mention that? I think we did mention that.
I think we covered that, I think,
yeah,
already.
Exactly.
Didn't we? Or, you know, yeah, the Nurse Ratched one? I thought we did.
Yeah, I think we did as well. That's the problem. We can't even remember what we've covered because they're remaking so much that from week to week, it's like, wait, did we mention that last week? Do we have to go back and check? Anyway.
I know we mentioned this lawsuit before.
We
but
have
it's a
mentioned
good one.
This lawsuit. The lawsuits by Harry Shearer, Rob Reiner, Michael McKean, and Christopher Guest about profits from the mockumentary This Is Spinal Tap have been sideswiped. The
profits? What profits?
Yeah. The problem, they're actually not lawsuits by those people, but in several cases, lawsuits by various companies and legal entities they created. A judge tossed out three of them and left Guest open to sue. However, the judge also kept open the possibility the others could sue directly as individuals. Further, a fraud claim was dismissed, though that too could be amended with more specifics. The fat lady hasn't even begun warming up yet on this one. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's just a procedural measure. They basically said, okay, that legal entity you created has no standing, but you might.
Right. This
so
is a very...
got to go back to the drawing board. But again, this is a lawsuit we're really interested in. They have no desire except to take it as far as they can, and we're hoping they do.
Yeah. I mean, this is basically saying, you know, that in Hollywood, people work through what's called a loan out company. And so Christopher Guest will work on a movie and his company will be paid for the services of Christopher Guest. And that's a way of dealing with taxes. And, you know, that way he's not paid the full amount. He doesn't have to pay a higher rate on personal taxes. And his company then has to pay a different level of tax.
And don't worry, Trump is trying to lower your pass-through tax rate.
Right.
So when you create these pass-through companies, he's like, oh, we don't want to charge you all that money because that's how I make most of my money.
Exactly.
But anyway.
But yeah. And so basically what he's saying is, guess what, Christopher Guest? Your company, which is a pass-through company, can't sue anybody. Okay. You, however, can. You as a human being can sue a company. I suggest
knock yourself out.
Yeah. I suggest you do that. That's what the judge is saying here.
Yeah.
Now, Veep star Julia Louis-Dreyfus has breast cancer. As she points out, 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer. The fact that no one is immune was brought home since she got the diagnosis the day after winning a Best Actress Emmy. In a statement, Louis-Dreyfus said, "The good news is that I have the most glorious group of supportive and caring family and friends and fantastic insurance through my union. The bad news is that not all women are so lucky. So let's fight all cancers and make universal health care a reality. Big deal or big whoop?"
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, how great for her to take something that's upsetting and, you know, scary and make it such a positive and say, I want to be public about it so women know and hear and say, you know what, I should get checked. It's been a year. And also bringing it back to the people who don't have the lucky position that she has of every, you know, all the money in the world to make sure she'll get the best treatment she can possibly get anywhere in the world she wants to go to. So great for her and Jimmy Kimmel and other people. You know, people mock celebrities in Hollywood, but they're taking something really difficult and personal and saying, you know what, I'm kind of lucky here because however awful it is, a lot of other people have it worse. So that's great for her to do.
Zelda and Super Mario can get back to work. Okay, they weren't actually technically on strike, okay? But for 1 year, the voice actors of SAG-AFTRA who contribute their talents to video games were on strike. Now that has ended, with early info on the new 3-year deal, including substantial pay increase via session fees and additional compensation, transparency in bookings about how long they would last, and so on, protection for those dealing with vocal stress, and more. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I fear it's a big whoop, because they were talking about voice actors getting more of the profits and more of the compensation for these huge, massive blockbuster video games that are grossing, you know, $500 million, $800 million. Those are obviously the rare ones, but they happen. And those voice actors are pretty important to them. So I'm not hearing anything that makes me think they had a huge win in terms of moving the dial, but maybe there's more specifics, but this happened a few weeks ago and I still haven't really heard great news about it. So it's clearly an improvement. I'm not sure it's as much of an improvement as they needed or deserved.
Sean Penn is coming to TV. The actor has signed onto his first TV series. It's a drama about colonizing Mars, which, of course, you know, is kind of like a nonfiction thing, right? Though sadly, yeah, not the long gestating adaptation of the Mars trilogy by author Kim Stanley Robinson. In this case, it's an original drama by Bo Willimon, the creator of the U.S. version of House of Cards. Oddly, that project is not at Willimon's home of Netflix, but over at Hulu. Similarly, Dick Wolf, one of the mainstays of NBC, for literally decades, by the way, is bringing an FBI drama to CBS. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, my head is spinning from Shonda Rhimes taking new projects away from ABC to Dick Wolf going from NBC to CBS. I mean, it just seems like everybody is up for grabs right now. And why is Bo Willimon not going to Netflix with this project? It's just bizarre how these people are just going everywhere. Is it just me, or is this really feel like the Wild West right now? And there's people are writing big checks, or there's just such instability that everybody is looking for the best, you know, home.
Well, you're actually right, because, you know, look, I was just in Brazil and, you know, everybody is nervous in the entertainment industry about these upstarts, whether it be Amazon or Apple or Netflix. Netflix right now is the big disruptor. In Brazil, Netflix came in and is hiring everybody away from places like HBO Latin America or the Cartoon Network, and all the executives are jumping ship, and all of these existing companies are nervous.
And that's upsetting for them, but isn't that good for the industry as a whole when you have a new player with deep pockets that looks like it's going to be there for the long haul? Well, I mean, isn't it good when ABC, CBS, and NBC suddenly had Fox and then the WB or the CW or, you know, HBO? These new people are maybe a little scary for them, but isn't it good for the industry as a whole? I'm just not sure why the talent who's had such long relationships with certain companies is jumping ship. That's what I guess I'm a little confused by.
More money.
Yeah.
I mean,
that may be the case for Will and Grace, right?
Well, that's true. Is it all about stacking or is it self-dealing? Maybe the courts will decide someday. The sitcom Will and Grace is coming to Hulu after a showdown between Hulu and Netflix for the valuable property getting a new 2-season run on NBC. Streaming is sure to be a high priority for fans, and Hulu won the war. The show's owner, NBC Universal, put out the word that Hulu won because it was more flexible in its demands over stacking. Stacking, of course, is a hot issue. Who gets to rerun a show's current season, all the episodes, okay, not just 5? Where can they run them, and for how long? Hulu's friendly approach carried the day. Of course, Netflix might argue this has more to do with self-dealing than stacking, since NBC Universal, or Comcast NBC Universal, owns the network showing new Will and Grace episodes, as well as all the, you know, the almost 200 episodes of the show's earlier 8-season run, and a third of Hulu. They own a third of Hulu. So basically, they own everything in that transaction. Nonsense, says NBC Universal. Or perhaps they would have if anyone asked. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, I think. It's a lawsuit in the making, isn't it? I mean, you laid it all out there. This feels like self-dealing to the 9th degree, and it just has to raise eyebrows for the people involved who want to know, is that really the did you turn down more money because you wanted to show an episode? How, you know, it's like, I'd really want to know.
Well, and it's kind of hard to say, right? Because what NBC Universal would say is, well, we turned down a little bit more money, but we kept more rights. So technically it was an even transaction. We would have gotten, and I'm just making numbers up here, $10 million from Netflix, but we would have had to give the stacking rights away. And just, you know, stacking rights means that you can show an entire season, okay, all at once rather than just the last 5 episodes. Okay, which is what you can see right now. Right. And so for Netflix, the entire season is what's important, okay? For DVD, the entire season is what's important. And so that's why NBC Universal wants to keep some of those. They want to be able to sell the DVD, not just sell it to Netflix and go, well, great, now we can't sell a DVD of Will and Grace. We have to just give it to Netflix. And that's really what...
But stacking seems even less important for a show like Will and Grace. It matters for a serialized show like American Crime, where if you haven't caught up, you're lost. But for Will and Grace, do you really need the whole season? That seems less important to me. They're standalone episodes, basically. I don't care if there's some arc they come up with this season. Basically, you can watch any episode and enjoy it.
Right. And I guess
the argument for a sitcom, that's a little dicier.
Right. And I guess going back to my little sample or analogy there, if Netflix was going to pay $10 million and Hulu was going to pay $8 million, but you get to keep the stacking rights, which might be worth $3 million, then obviously the Hulu deal is better. The problem is quantifying that delta there between $8 and $10 million. Can NBC Universal quantify it? I would imagine they can.
We'll let a court decide.
Exactly. Almost a minute before American Idol started filming a new round of auditions, the ABC show finally hired its 3 judges. Ryan Seacrest is back hosting, of course, and pop star Katy Perry will be joined by country artist Luke Bryan and R&B legend Lionel Richie. Which one of them will be the hatchet man? Which the breakout personality? And will anyone actually care? Katy got $25 million, Ryan got $15 million, and at first, that left just $10 million for the last 2 judges, and Richie turned down a lowball offer. He finally accepted, but we don't know for how much. Bryan said he was thrilled to give new talent a platform for success. Richie perhaps wanting to emphasize his importance, emphasized how much he would bring to the show, being an artist and a writer and a producer, but how much did he get paid? This all means Idol will have to be very, 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 very successful just to break even. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I feel like they're just setting themselves up to fail with this massive payday for everybody. It just seems like everybody's going to have a caustic eye towards it and just going, you know. And Lionel Richie and Luke Bryan and Katy Perry are all unknown quantities in terms of being a judge. You know, just being a talented pop star doesn't mean you're going to be a good judge and have that personality and the willingness to say the hard things in an interesting way. So this is going to be a hard row for this show to pull it off. I think they have to make it live. I'm hoping they're not going to have results shows and they're just going to have voting that night. So you don't have to wait another night for the results. I don't know what they're going to do, but they have to make it television that you have to watch that night. You know, which is what most live TV is like this, or that's the feel. But they just have to make it more important than ever that you're there paying attention right then. I don't know if this is going to do it. You know, Luke Bryan, Lionel Richie, I wish him well. But it feels like such a doomed failure. If they just waited longer and took their time and made it fresh, who knows?
You know, when I was in Brazil, I actually watched the Brazilian version of The Voice.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same. Like, I'm like, I think.
Well, sure, that's what they do.
I think they actually stole the set, in fact.
They have a Brazilian version of Wheel of Fortune. I mean, yeah. that's what people do all over the world. It's licensed, of course, but yeah.
Right. And actually, you know, speaking of licensing, you know, material and renting sets, high schools around the country produce musicals and plays, often the first experience many people have with live theater, and surely the only experience most will have taking part in it. The most produced shows for the last school year have been touted up. They've been counted. The number one musical, what do you think it was? It was The Addams Family, followed by Disney's Beauty and the Beast, Shrek, and Seussical, all the way down to Grease at number 10. The number one play? Almost Maine, by John, how do you pronounce his name? Cariani?
I think so.
Now, that's a compilation of 9 short pieces about love and loss featuring various characters. Amidst War Horses by Shakespeare, Arthur Miller, and of course, Thornton Wilde's Our Town, you'll also find another new show, Peter and the Star Catcher. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, first of all, this is what, when you're watching kids audition on Broadway or doing some of these showcases I've seen, this is why for the last few years they've all been performing songs from the Addams Family. I'm like, what is going on here? Why are they singing songs from that show? It's because that's the one they're doing. I'm not sure why that one became a favorite. Almost Maine, similarly, seems to be because it's suited for high schools, has lots of different characters, 9 short pieces. It's easier for people to get through and deal with, you know, just a 10-minute piece rather than a whole play. So there are reasons these work for good and ill. And it's interesting to know what kids are seeing, what they're playing in, and, you know, what they come through when they get to Broadway.
Right. And keep in mind, and you know this, Michael, that, you know, these production companies will put together whole packages of here's the set, here's the costumes. And so maybe the reason that the Addams Family is being done is because they're making it easy to license and, you know, put on the show.
Right. Everybody wants to do that, but they must be doing a particularly good job.
Right.
So the shows go to Broadway and then they come and there's a lot of money to be made. So, you know, let's not write off The Great Comet yet. It closed on Broadway, but they're hoping to do touring productions in London, and they're hoping to, you know, do things like this down the road, crazy as it sounds. And that may be one reason why investors are saying they want to look at the books on The Great Comet. They're confused. Why did this show that virtually never made less than $890,000 a week to $1 million, why did it close? What's going on here? And the producers are saying, it's a total waste of time. Don't look at the books. You're boring yourself.
Right.
But they are suing and saying, we want to look. We're confused why this show shut down. So we'll have to find out if we learn more information about that. But it's, you know, when you want to know a show, it has a long life after Broadway. And even if it doesn't do great on Broadway, the fact that The Great Comet played there means community theaters, tours, overseas productions all have a better chance of succeeding.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, okay, this week we're talking about a late-night car crash it involved the star of the CW primetime soap, Riverdale. And happily, it involved no fatalities, mostly just a smashed-up car and a sigh of relief for actor KJ Apa, who plays Archie. He was tired, and that's all, really, and his car hit a pole. Cole Sprouse, who plays Jughead, was supposed to be riding with him, but he didn't. And that's good, because the passenger seat was totaled in the accident, and really, it would seem like that would be the end of the story, but not quite, really, because it sparked an investigation by SAG-AFTRA, the actors' unions. Their angry denials by the CW and an upwelling of concern in Hollywood over on-set safety, which in recent weeks, as we've talked about here on the show, has included the death of a stunt person, arguably not trained for the stunt they tackled, and possible murder of a location scout, as we talked about earlier in this show.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story. It told some stuff I wasn't aware of at all. And it's actually WBTV. CW has, of course, also put out information, but the person making the show is WBTV, and they're the ones who've been sort of defensively providing more information. You know, first we had early reports saying that App had been driving back to his hotel after a 16-hour day and was taken to the hospital. And WBTV said, no, it wasn't a 16-hour day. It was merely a 14.2-hour day. And you're like, wow, if that's your defense, that's not so good. 14.2 does not actually sound like a short day, does it?
Right. And I guess, you know, some people would say, look, you know, they work 5 minutes, they go sit in the trailer for 3 hours. They work another 5 minutes. That's true and not true. Okay. On these TV shows, on 1 hour dramas, they have like 8 days to make these 1 hour dramas, and it's rolling productions. Okay. So for the directors, that's why you'll sometimes see directors do every other episode or every third episode, because they shoot, they prep 1 week, they shoot another week, they do post for, you know, 2 weeks, and then they go back and do it all over again.
But a 14-hour day, nobody thinks he's acting for all 14 hours straight. The fact that they're sometimes in their trailer, whatever, doesn't mean that it's still, they're there till after midnight and then they got to go home.
Right.
But, which is what happened here. And of course, that 14.2-hour day, I immediately wanted to know, does that include his driving time? Because it was a driving time of 45 minutes one way from where he was staying in Vancouver to the set that they were at. So he headed home after midnight and he had a 45-minute drive, and that's when he got his accident. They also said he was treated by first responders but didn't actually go to a hospital. Okay.
Okay, well, you know, I can't answer the question that you just asked about whether it included the 45 minutes is included in the 14.2-hour workday, but it is supposed to be included when you're doing payments. So when you're paying a cinematographer, for instance, if they have to wake up at 4 a.m. and drive to the set, very often that will be included.
Well, I think that's actually a significant contractual debating point and issues that they keep raising as far as when do we start the clock? Is it when you leave your hotel or is it when you arrive on the set? That's actually not a set thing. So there is debate about that. That's why when they said that, that's the first thing I thought, well, in this case, what does that include? And are you including the fact that he had to drive? They also said to WBTV, hey, if you feel sleepy, everyone's told repeatedly, just speak up. You know, just tell them I'm tired, and you can either get a driver or they'll let you stay at a hotel right near where the set is, so you don't have to go all the way back to where you're actually staying. You know, they said we tell people that all the time. And what's the response to that?
Well, of course, if you're an actor on a set like that and you're kind of making noise about, I'm so tired, can you please, you know, it almost looks like you're getting special treatment
or running up
the bills. You know, running.
Yeah, you're like, I want a driver. And they roll their eyes and they make you feel like you're being a jerk or not a team player and you're costing more. You know, the onus should not be on you, is what activists say, to speak up and demand a driver or a separate hotel room when they're already paying for one. Because then they're like, oh, you know, other people don't need it and they're going home, or you're demanding this special hotel room. You know,
and by the way,
a problem person.
That's why these days run so long. Because it's, you know, just take it for the team, you know, and it's kind of like this peer pressure and the reality of making these types of movies or in this case, television shows. Sometimes the days are really long. Sometimes.
Yeah, that was another argument they made. Well, the day before he only worked 7 hours and the day before that he only worked 2. Well, yes, that's true, but still worked a 14-hour day and had to drive home for almost an hour. So it doesn't change the fact that he was going to be tired on the day he works 14 hours and has to go home after midnight. Me, I'm just waking up at midnight, so I'm happy as a clam. But like 6 a.m, if I have to wake up and drive somewhere, I'm not going to be at my best. So everyone's different, but a 14-hour day is a 14-hour day. Here's the thing I really didn't know about, that the rules for transportation are different on location, especially when it's overseas, or rather, I should say, outside the continental U.S. According to the story, actors are responsible for their own transportation on location, especially when outside the U.S. This show was shooting in Vancouver, so technically the actors are responsible for their own transportation. That is so weird to me. I think it would be the opposite. I would feel like if you're shooting in New York and L.A., people have their own cars or public transportation or a cab, or they live there. It's just easier for them. They can always call a cab. But on location, you're in another country and that's when you're responsible for your transportation? That just seems bizarre to me. I can't understand why it would be like that.
Well, and it's one of the negotiating points in contracts. So it's one of the things.
But why would it be overseas when you're out of
I just can't fathom why,
if anything, you would expect it to be the opposite. That overseas, of course, will handle your transportation, but when you're in New York and LA, you're on your own. And I would go, well, at least that's logical to me. I really can't. I'm just wondering why the heck that became.
That might be a union thing where it's like they say, look, in the U.S. we can control it because we have Teamsters. In other countries, we have no way of, you know, we can't control local employees.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that a friend of mine in casting pointed out was that, hey, you know what? A lot of people, too, when they're hiring overseas, even in Canada, they're not going to be SAG-AFTRA. So a lot of people, especially the bit players, the people on that week, the people who have less ability to speak up and demand a car, you know, just a guest actor, someone who's not a regular on the show, not the star, that person is even less likely to say, I want a hotel room. I'm tired, because they're going to be like, oh, this person's a pain in the ass. They ran up our bill. We're not going to use them next time. And that's another reason why the onus should not be the actor. And those people are not necessarily under a SAG-AFTRA contract. So whatever contract has been negotiated, it's going to be different for them.
Well, and wasn't that part of like the SAG-AFTRA thing where Gabriel Carteris, who was the president of SAG-AFTRA, if she isn't, I think she still is.
Oh, she is. Yeah, she won re-election. It was very close.
And she that was part of one of the sticking points in the latest contract negotiation was the transportation to and from set. Wasn't it?
That's right. And the opposing team claimed that when they signed their new deal with the studios, that they sort of caved on this. And the Kateris' people said, hey, we are just simply recognizing how this actually has been working for years on set, on location, especially in other countries. So while you say, oh, we caved, we're like, this is what people have already been doing. And this is what's been happening movie to movie and show to show. And we finally just conceded to reality. So now this happened. And they're on red alert. Like, this was an issue during the election. She won re-election, but they're taking this very seriously. I believe she headed out herself to be part of the team investigating. And they released a statement saying, this is an extremely troubling situation. We are deeply concerned about the safety of performers on the Riverdale set. We are sending a team to Vancouver to review the circumstances surrounding safety issues affecting performers on this production. So they're not going to drop the ball on this one, at least in this particular case. They want to find out what's going on and what they can do about it. And it is possible if this had happened before the election, it might have gone a different way.
Yeah, I agree. And look, I don't know that this will affect our listeners per se, but certainly it affects the industry at large, specifically when it comes to transportation, which has really been this kind of issue that's it's been long simmering.
Well, happily, nobody died on the set and everybody is okay, but you don't want to, if it highlights a safety issue, you don't want to drop the ball and say, oh, well, we dodged a bullet that time. We want to say, hey, maybe there's something here that needs to be fixed.
Yes, but since we're speaking about death, maybe it's time for us to talk about some people who did actually pass away. Cy Newhouse, S.I. Newhouse of Condé Nast, the big magazine magnate, he died at the age of 89.
That's right. A long storied career with all the Condé Nast properties, including the New Yorker, which they bought in the mid 80s. And they sort of eyed warily Condé Nast, but it turned out to be a good thing for them. Stabilized that magazine, that august institution financially, and they're flourishing and doing well. So end of a storied career for Cy. And of course, Hugh Hefner died in his pajamas, I imagine, at 91.
Yes. Look, he is well known for those who don't know. You know the
oh my God,
the founder
you don't have
of
to
Playboy.
Explain who Hugh Hefner and Playboy is.
Yeah, but you, one little factoid. Do you know where he is being interred?
This is so creepy. He's being interred next to Marilyn Monroe. He bought the plot next to hers. That poor woman. And she was one. Was she the first cover girl?
Yes.
Or one of the yes.
Of
she was
Playboy
the first
magazine.
Cover girl on Playboy magazine. And, you know, her whole career bedeviled by her image and how people took her image and trying to escape it. And now she's got Hugh Hefner next to her for all of eternity. His legacy is mixed, to put it mildly. You know, they published some great journalism and some great interviews, but they also have a troubled history in terms of the objectification of women and where Hugh Hefner stood on that. And they're like, no, I was a feminist. It's like, yeah, no, you sort of.
Yeah,
maybe you read it for the articles.
Oh, yeah. Then we talked about it on this show where they decided to take out all the pictures and then they decided to put all the pictures back in. And yeah.
Well, they didn't take out. They just took out the full nudity.
Right.
They never took out the pictures of pretty women. But there you go. So Hugh Hefner has died. We'll debate what it means culturally, but certainly he's a figure. And Tom Petty died and is a warning sign for media everywhere. CBS News reported he died and then they had to retract it because they wanted to be first. And turned out he wasn't dead yet. So they had to say, actually, he's not so dead. He's clinging to life. And then later they got to say, okay, yes, he's dead. So sort of an unseemly end. A rock and roll legend. He died at 66. He had a massive heart attack. Being a heartbreaker, I guess that is fitting in a way.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that.
I didn't think about that either. To my sister, who knows nothing about music, mentioned that. I go, oh, actually, that's a good point. But Tom Petty's a fun guy. He probably would enjoy that. A little mild joke. I don't know if it's a joke, but like it's an odd and funny coincidence. But really came out of nowhere. And, you know, he's a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. He played the Super Bowl halftime show. He's had decades of hit albums. If you're thinking of what to do to sort of pick up on him, there's a great documentary by Peter Bogdanovich, probably the last great thing he's done or ever will do. And it's called Running Down a Dream. And it's 4 hours long. And you think that is way more. Oh, it's actually interesting. As you watch it, it's actually quite interesting. And don't say, play Tom Petty. Say something like play Full Moon Fever or play Damn the Torpedoes or even one of the Wilbury albums. You know, play Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 or Volume 3. Just don't play Volume 2 because that one sucks.
You know, I'm going to have to cut that out and reverse it or do something so that you don't trigger all the Amazon Echoes out there. Now, that said, this so came out of nowhere that he just played the Hollywood Bowl last Thursday.
Yes, he did. It just ended a big tour. He said it's probably the last big tour they would ever do. And in fact, it now will be, of course. There's only two Wilburys left, just Bob Dylan and Jeff Lynne. We've had Roy Orbison, George Harrison, and now Tom Petty. I mean, certainly we didn't expect Tom Petty to be the next one to go. So that's very sad. A really interesting career, though. You know, he had, you know how many top 10 hits he had? Two.
Really?
Two.
Okay.
Don't Do Me Like That and Free Fallin'. That's it. He had a lot of songs that were hits on rock radio, but he was not a pop star. Most of his albums sold maybe platinum. He had a couple albums that went triple platinum, and his one solo album, well, he had a number of them, but his big solo album was Full Moon Fever. That went 5 times platinum. So he had a long, steady career. Platinum, platinum, platinum. Good song, good song, good song. He worked and performed with Bob Dylan, recorded an album with Johnny Cash. And he got bigger and bigger and bigger in a way as his career went on. I mean, this is a band that toured endlessly, and they've sort of been playing bigger venues as they go along. They just keep building on their audience until recent years where, you know, they're sort of playing like superstars, like the Stones and Springsteen, where that was never their commercial success. But, you know, you play good music for a lot of years, and it's going to catch up, and people are going to wake up. In fact, I was at a cafe yesterday when he died. He died yesterday, right?
Yes, he did. Yesterday night. Officially.
And, well, he had the heart attack. I just heard about it from a friend, and I walked into a cafe literally 5 minutes later. So nobody knew. And certainly the music playing in this place was not keyed to Tom Petty's illness. That was not why the song was playing, because it's a nationally piped in mix of music. It's not even a local radio station. So this just happened to be the song playing. It was Free Fallin'. And the staff behind the counter, who are Black and Latino and typically know a lot more about hip-hop than classic rock. One of the girls started singing Free Fall on the chorus, and then a couple other people joined in, and she just said, yeah, everybody knows that song. I mean, and that just happened. I'm like, you know, he just had a heart. They're like, what? You know, they had no idea. But, you know, that's, you know, you build up a lot of hits, and you build up a lot of really good songs, and your legacy will last. Yeah, you know, and of course, you think about Tom Petty, and you can't help but think of the tragedy in Las Vegas. Country artists were performing, and this horrible, yet another mass shooting in North America in the U.S. I mean, we've been averaging one a day, apparently, for the last year. The New York Times totted it up. You know, we already had the tragedy in London with Ariana Grande. Now this, there's simply no way to protect people from this. It was a guy in a hotel nearby smashing out windows and just firing down on people. There's no security or no thing that you can do to keep people safe forever. Some idiot wants to do something with a truck or a gun like that, but there are things you can do, like change laws and stuff. But you think about rock concerts and people, how dreadful that something that should bring joy becomes something where you have to be worried.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't cover it because there's not much we can add to it. And it's, yeah.
Other than vote in a midterm election, you know.
Correct.
This week, the Republicans were about to pass a law saying you can buy silencers without a background check. Because what we need are more silencers on guns.
Yeah, well, and look, it was really noisy, so we need more. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, good God.
Anyway. That wraps up our show for this week. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free and aggregate podcasts. You can find our show, and you can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as those ways to subscribe to us, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to contact us. Dirt at showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
Call me by your name when you do.
Oh, that's the movie that you saw at the New York Film Festival.
That's right.
Now, we also have a handle on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is where you can find us, or facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox is our Facebook page. You can like us there. All that information, again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's iwon'tbackdown.com.
Oh, a reference to Tom Petty and one of his, his hit songs. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to figure out what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.